Hello, I'm Simon Wakeling, and welcome to this month's edition of Changing the World with CSU Researchers. This show is produced for 2MCE on Wiradjuri land by the Researcher Development Team in the Office of Research Services at Charles Sturt University. Today's programme is slightly different to our usual format. While we'll still be hearing about the amazing work being done by doctoral students at CSU, the focus of today's show is on this year's 3-Minute Thesis competition. 3-Minute Thesis, or 3MT for short, has very simple rules. PhD students must present their research in just 180 seconds, with only a single static PowerPoint slide to support them. 3MT began at the University of Queensland in 2008, but has since grown into a truly international competition, with entries now coming from students all across the Asia-Pacific region. CSU holds its own 3MT competition each year, with the winner going forward to the Asia-Pacific finals. So in today's programme, we hear from 3 CSU finalists, hear their 3MT presentations, and find out a bit more about their research. First of all, let's meet our contributors.
My name is Maddie Ray. I'm with the School of Agricultural, Environment and Veterinary Sciences, and my PhD looks at parasites in our native ducks.
Hi, my name's Olivia. I'm also in the School of Ag, Environmental and Veterinary Sciences, and my PhD is looking at the response of crop species to phosphorus fertilizers.
Yes, so my name is Diana, and I'm also from the School of Agriculture, Environment and Veterinary Sciences, and my PhD is on the interactions of different fungal trunk disease pathogens within a single vine.
Let's kick things off with Maddie Ray's 3MT presentation. Remember, the rules are that Maddie has to communicate her research in no more than 3 minutes.
Over 50 years. It has been over 50 years since any significant work has been done on native duck parasites. That is twice my lifetime. For some of you in the audience, that may be your entire lifetime or a significant percentage of your lifetime. But why should we care about parasites, and particularly those infecting ducks? Parasites are everywhere and affect every organism on the planet, including you and me. They are some of the greatest adapters of all time, and within short periods of time can adapt to changes in climate and to new hosts to allow for the completion of their life cycles. Parasites play vital roles in ecosystems and in some cases act as the top predators. They can also significantly influence stress levels of their hosts, which can lead to decreases in immune function. Without them, however, ecosystems would completely collapse. Not only are parasites vital to natural ecosystems, but they can have significant impacts on man-made ecosystems, such as agricultural systems, for example, impacting the production potential of livestock. With the development of new technologies, we can further understand the impact that these parasites can have on host health, along with being able to get a glimpse into the health of an ecosystem, as they can tell us a lot about the changing environment. Now, imagine these teeny tiny top predators being able to fly simply by infecting their native duck hosts. Ducks can travel hundreds of kilometres in quite short periods of time, and it has also been suggested that they house one of the highest parasite diversities due to using both aquatic and terrestrial environments. So when you combine a potential top predator with a duck that can travel hundreds of kilometres in one day, you can just imagine the destruction this could entail. My research focuses on parasites infecting our native duck species and how they influence certain measures of stress. Being able to sample parasite data from both deceased birds and live birds, I am able to have a full scope on the parasites infecting both the gastrointestinal and cardiovascular system, while also being able to study parasites in their adult form, which is extremely useful in the identification process. My research has already found several species of worm infecting a variety of duck species with varying levels of infection per species. One of these worms is a flatworm, and it's actually able to infect us humans and causes nasty stomach problems. Although they have no wings, by hitching a ride on their duck host, parasites can indeed fly without wings. Cheers.
So there you go. That's a 3-minute thesis and a fantastic job by Maddie to communicate her complex research. As a follow-up, I asked her if she could explain a bit more about her data collection.
So my research does involve two data collection aspects. So one aspect is from deceased birds. So basically I opportunistically collect them, I necropsy them, I go through them, and I basically filter out and filter through all of the organs, and including all of the digester and all that kind of jazz through the organs, and I look for parasites. So I basically just go on the hunt for adult parasites and see what I can find. From there, I then take these parasites and I do morphological and molecular studies on them. So I look at how they are presenting. So are they, you know, how long are they? How wide are they? What kind of key features are differing across the species and all that kind of stuff? And then the molecular, it's all the DNA, so extracting DNA, aligning the DNA, doing phylogeny, so your taxonomy, that's kind of more my style of stuff with the dead things. And then with the live birds, we are, well, hoping to go back out into the field, collect blood, and then look at our blood parasites. So you can do that using molecular and morphology again. So we do the blood smears, we look for the parasites in the blood, and then we also do the molecular stuff to find out what exact parasites they are. And using that blood as well, we can tell a lot about how these guys are actually impacting the health of the animal, looking at the stress levels. So looking at things like the ratio of juvenile to adult or mature red blood cells and your white blood cell counts and all that kind of stuff, PC packed cell volume and all that kind of jazz. But yeah, that's basically everything that we do data-wise.
As regular listeners will know, we're always keen to understand the potential impact of doctoral students' research. Maddie explains.
So ultimately, a lot of different people and industries will get benefit out of this research. Generally speaking, in Australia, we're very, very far behind in our parasitology knowledge. We know everything there is to know about our livestock currently, but we don't know about how our wildlife could potentially impact our agricultural animals. So, for example, a few of the parasites that I've already come across in these ducks have actually been reported in chooks and other sort of production birds overseas. So there is the potential for these parasites to very quickly move into our domesticated animals if they're not already there. The other thing is as well as zoonosis. So being able to pick up these parasites from the birds themselves. The flatworm that I mentioned in my 3MT is actually from the group Echinostoma, which is actually a very, they're pretty nasty, basically. They get us really, really sick. And they appear a lot in developing countries. And we just need to know about them because there is the potential. We do have people here that hunt ducks for the consumption of them. So just making people aware that, okay, well, these are what they carry, so you do need to be careful. And not only from that aspect too, you know, you go down to the park, you go down to a lake or something and you sit down and you put your hand in duck poop and then you eat something, you're likely to have had a parasite egg on your hand and you've just eaten that parasite egg and you don't really know that you've done that until a few days to weeks later when you're, you know, very, very uncomfortable and very crook.
On that cheerful note, let's move to our second 3MT presentation. Here's Olivia Brunton.
People and plants have more in common than you might think. We both require nutrients to grow and to function, but we get them from different places. People get them from their diet, but plants get them from the soil. But what if there's a deficiency? People can change their diet, but plants can't just uproot and move to new soil. So farmers provide nutrients such as phosphorus as fertilizers. Phosphorus is one of the largest nutrient requirements for plant growth and production, and farmers apply phosphorus fertilizers every year to meet these needs. But they're expensive, and phosphorus resources are non-renewable. What the world has is all that we've got. So to conserve phosphorus resources and reduce phosphorus input costs, farmers aim to improve the phosphorus fertilizer use efficiency. Simply put, to maximize production with the smallest addition of phosphorus. One strategy to improve the phosphorus fertilizer use efficiency is to optimize fertilizer placement. That's where my PhD comes in. Current practice is to place the phosphorus fertilizer near to the seed in what's known as a band, which creates a concentrated zone of phosphorus. But during the season, what can happen is this soil layer can dry out and phosphorus uptake to the plant is reduced because phosphorus uptake is driven by soil moisture. So in this scenario, the supplement we provided, the fertilizer, doesn't work. So what now? My project is looking at if we can change the delivery. I'm looking at whether we can ban the phosphorus deeper in the soil, where it's likely to remain moist and phosphorus availability to the plant can be maintained. But not all plants are created equal. Different plant species have different rooting structures, which impact how they explore the soil for resources. I'm conducting controlled environment experiments, looking at the root structures of three of the main cropping species of southern Australia to see how their roots respond to this deeper placement of phosphorus and whether they can all benefit from this new strategy. So far, I've found that the roots of all three species can find the deep phosphorus, but some species are better at using it than others. Wheat and canola are masters at foraging for phosphorus, and they can readily tap their roots into this deep phosphorus. But chickpea is a poor forager for phosphorus, and current practice may actually be best. So what does all this mean? Where we place the fertilizer to get the most efficient use will depend on the plant species, and we need to match the plant species with the most appropriate fertilizer placement to maximize production and to feed us all.
A wonderful presentation from Olivia, and it should be noted that the CSU 3MT judges agreed, naming Olivia winner of the CSU 3MT competition. That meant she went on to represent CSU in the Asia Pacific finals in September. So huge congratulations to Olivia for that. But aside from winning competitions, what does her PhD actually involve and what could its impact be?
So I'm based in Canberra at the CSIRO. And so I have some facilities here. It's a controlled environment cabinet. And it basically looks like this big walk-in freezer, and you can control the light, you can control the temperature and the humidity, like you control everything. So I have a series of pod experiments with my three species, and they go in there for about 5 weeks. And then I harvest them all, wash all of the roots out, and go ahead and scan them and look at what they're doing. Deep banding of phosphorus has had a really big impact in environments where the topsoil is very prone to drying. So that's northern Queensland, Western Australia. And because of all this big success, it's become a really big interest in southern Australia, but we have that very different environment. So finding out whether or not in our different environment we can still have a benefit for deep banding of phosphorus, it could really, really impact a lot of farmers.
Our final 3MT presentation today is from Diana Joy Amorio.
Well, becoming friends with somebody is good. This is not true for fungal trunk disease pathogens within vines. Healthy vines make great wine. And did you know that 46% of Australian adults now drink wine, and its consumption has increased significantly in both genders? I'm willing to bet that most of us here on Zoom have their preferred wine, red, white, or sparkling. In fact, it is the most consumed alcoholic beverage, according to the latest consumption report. But a group of diseases called grapevine trunk diseases, or GTDs, is a threat to vineyard sustainability. These diseases are likened to cancer, where they kill the vines from the inside without early visible symptoms. However, though, when the symptoms appear, the vines are already dying. The main catch, the pathogens associated with the two significant GTDs, Petri disease and Bottiaea dieback, are present together in individual vines. The impact of their interactions on disease development, however, has never been investigated. My aim is to understand how these pathogens colonize and persist within vines. These pathogens can either like each other and act synergistically, with their combined effect greater than their additive effect. Or they can hate each other and act antagonistically with their results less than their pure summation. When paired in artificial media, these pathogens revealed specific interactions, which proceeded me to examine this in living plants by quantifying the amount of their DNA when they're inoculated together versus alone in a single vine. Now, the ability of these pathogens to colonize and coexist in a single host does not happen by chance or luck. A shared perspective exists that some low molecular weight compounds called secondary metabolites are responsible for their survival. I am thrilled to investigate whether these metabolites are upregulated or downregulated when these pathogens are subjected to co-culture conditions and discover novel metabolites that has never been characterized. And so the next time you grab that perfect glass of wine, think about the healthy vines that made it possible without these diseases. And that sometimes friendship cannot be viewed as a positive thing after all, especially with the impact of these diseases on vine yield and longevity. Thank you.
As with Maddie and Olivia, I asked Diana what exactly her research involves.
Yes, so I'm actually investigating the interactions in two perspectives. So I'm looking into the interactions of these fungal pathogens, firstly, in vitro. So meaning I kind of pair the pathogens together in an artificial media. And there is some synergistic, or to check whether there is antagonistic or synergistic. And after that, I will check them in vivo. So that means in plants itself. So I will look into the interactions, whether firstly on detached canes. So I will inoculate these pathogens together versus alone. And then how will I know the interactions, whether they're antagonistic or synergistic versus the control? So I will quantify the DNA. So I will use a quantitative PCR. So it's a molecular type of thing. So, and then I will, from this one, I will inoculate them on potted plants as well. So I will check the interactions, whether they affect, for example, the production of berries, whether these interactions will affect disease development on single plant, or the leaves development on single plant. And then lastly, I will check what is the mechanism behind this interaction. So I will do a bit of chemical analysis, which I'm doing as well at the moment. So I am trying to extract some kind of toxin, which we hypothesized are the ones responsible. So these toxins called secondary metabolites are the ones responsible if they are acting antagonistically or synergistically with each other.
So will this work have a big impact on the viticulture industry?
Yes. Yes, of course, definitely. So actually, this one group of disease that I was talking about a while ago, we call them Petri disease, is actually not really present here in Australia. So I think it's more on the biosecurity, especially more on the vineyard. So what if these two pathogen groups are synergistic with each other? Then we expect like more disease that's happening in the near future that will affect the grapevine production, the fruit production, and eventually the wine. So we will have like reduced wine production as well.
You may be wondering why doctoral students choose to put themselves through this process. Writing and performing a 3-minute thesis presentation is clearly not easy. I asked our contributors what they found to be the benefits of taking part. Here's Maddie and then Olivia.
For me personally, it has definitely helped me with my public speaking and my confidence. Honestly, it was the very first time I've ever been able to get up in front of people, speak, and not black out and not have a panic attack. So for me, it was very, very beneficial.
I definitely agree with the confidence part of it. It is a very different sort of scenario. I don't want to call it low stakes because it is a competition, but it's not a conference with like all of the experts in your field and you're citing them every day and you're so stressed meeting them. it's very like low stakes, like in the sense of they're people who are just excited to hear about what you're there to say. They're not going to pick apart each individual word you say. So that was a good part of it. And then it also really helps you break down what the main point of your PhD is, what your story is, which I found really helpful coming into writing, being like, I tend to get bogged down in all the really little details that I was like, this happened and it was so exciting. Breaking down what the main story is has been really helpful.
Diana agrees.
Yeah, I actually agree to Maddie and Olivia. So I think for me, and most importantly, I was able to pin down the key message of my PhD research project. And I think I'm more confident to share it to, for example, a student, a friend, that they can really understand it, like in a way, oh, they appreciate my research, because I was able to communicate that in a non-specialist audience. When I say friends or foes, they're like, oh, wow. And then, of course, definitely it helped me enhance my public speaking skills, my communication, and this kind of publicity. You know, yes, I'm just kidding. So.
I also asked our contributors what they felt the most challenging parts of the process were, and all three agreed on this.
I think for me, the most challenging part in doing these 3 minutes is actually writing your script in just 3 minutes while still capturing all the essential message of your PhD. And of course, using a language that's not scientific, but in a non-specialist language. So I think I took a lot of time doing that than just memorizing, but really brainstorming and structuring my script as well.
I definitely agree. I think that was the hardest part, is getting it to the 3 minutes.
3 minutes.
And it takes so much longer than you think it will, because you're like, 3 minutes? Yeah, I know what my PhD is about. I know why I'm doing it. It's going to be really easy. But it took a really long time. And like really figuring out what your message is. It does take, like, it's great in figuring it out, because like, you know, you can really nail down, like we said before, nail down what it's about. Getting to that point is really hard.
I agree with both the others. Just trying to get everything in 3 minutes. For me, a lot of it was trying to balance the amount of background, the amount of actual, and the amount of results. Just trying to find that nice balance between all three, because you have to cover a lot and a very broad range of category, well, not categories, but you've got to cover basically, yes, like everything from the background to your literature review, all the way through to your methods, methodologies, all the way through to your results. And it's just, yeah, extremely difficult to pick and choose what is worthwhile talking about.
So what tips might our 3MT experts have for others considering taking part in the future? Here's Maddie.
I've got a few, so I've got four. Firstly, be confident. You know what you're on about. You know what your research is. If you're up there and you stumble, you know exactly what comes next. Even though you think you don't in the moment, your brain will take over and you'll keep talking. Don't stress and waste energy on it. I can honestly say, which is, this is so bad, but it's probably one of the least prepared I've ever been for a presentation, and it's the best I've ever done. So I definitely think it's, you know, not losing sleep over it, not wasting hours and hours and hours trying to perfect it. Just get it done, get it ready, get it to go. I think I practiced in front of my supervisor once or twice a day before it was actually on. So yeah, just be confident in what you're doing. Make it simple. Just think, okay, I've got to convey this to a kindy kid, basically, and see how you'd be able to do that. Personally, I have nieces and nephews, so I used that to my advantage, and I just sat there and went, okay, how do I explain my research to these guys and see if they can reiterate what it is to me? And they can, which is pretty cool. And then a final tip and trick is just for the actual presentation itself, is I always find it really handy if you pick a spot in the audience, kind of towards the back, where there's not really anybody looking at you or nobody there, and you just kind of look at that spot or like three different spots, Or alternatively, you can always find one person in the audience that like won't take their eyes off you. And for whatever reason, that's very comforting to me. So I just talk to that person. I ignore everybody else. Like I'm just having a one-on-one conversation. And they're my tips and tricks.
Olivia also has some suggestions for prospective three-minute thesis competitors.
Yeah, I have a few as well. The first one is to definitely go to the professional development seminars about the 3MTs that the uni does. And watching the previous 3MTs, before you go into it, you're a bit like, "How? I don't understand the structure." So watching them and going to the development classes was really, really helpful. And then I'm a little different to Maddie. It might be a personal preference. But my advice is to know your script backwards and forwards. Like after you nail it down, like after you know what you're going to say, just do it in a bunch of different places. Like I did it walking my dogs and at dinner, and I just told my mum it over dinner. I did it a lot in front of the bathroom mirror, which feels really silly. But just to know sort of what you're going to look like, it really helped take away the nerves of like, what if I'm going to stand up there and look like a bit of a dummy? Definitely the confidence, but I would say no backwards and forwards. So depending on what the type of person you are. And then my last one is to not be scared of ditching the work that you've already done. So I went through three analogies before I landed on the one that I actually used. And it's sometimes really hard to be like, oh, I worked so hard on this. I don't want to get rid of it. I want to make it work. But sometimes you just have to go, never mind, try a new thing and see if that works instead.
Diana agrees and also highlights the importance of being bold.
Well, I think they have both covered it all. Yes, but I think what really helped me, especially in doing my script, because it's not easy. It's like, I think Olivia has mentioned it, that's really true. It's just like 3 minutes, but it took me like how many days to write on my script? And I was like, oh my God, this is not easy at all, because I just thought at the back of my mind it's just 3 minutes, you know, just join and go with it. But then I think when I was doing my script, I focus on my audience, I focus on the fact that how can I, at least I have said it a while ago, how can I inspire at least one person somehow with my research? And that's very important for me. And then I think secondly is just take the risk, be bold and have fun and be in the moment. And of course, appreciate those people, for example, those participants, those people that are helping you in having a successful 3-minute thesis.
To finish off our discussion, I asked all three contributors what they're planning to do next.
At the moment, I try to focus on my PhD first. I haven't thought of that actually, but that's a good question. I think I love teaching Simon, so perhaps I can have a stint on becoming a lecturer and doing research as well. So yeah, fingers crossed. So what the future holds on me, but yeah, that's something that I am really considering.
So yes, trying to get this PhD written up. I'm in the final kind of leaps now. So yes, the after PhD life is very, very, very rapidly coming at me. So far, honestly, I'll probably end up in academia, hopefully. I have already started kind of teaching into a variety of different subjects as a demonstrator, and I've fallen in love with it. But if not, I'll probably end up in biosecurity.
I am also in the final stages, so I'm getting very nervous about how quickly June is approaching. I have a lot left to do, but I am really hoping to stay in research. Like, it's been a really positive experience. I really hope to carry on. So I've been sort of talking to people about the benefits of doing a postdoc, sort of seeing if that's an option.
That's it for today, I'm afraid. A big thank you to Olivia Brunton, Maddie Ray and Diana Joy Amorio. And congratulations on developing and delivering such fascinating 3-minute thesis presentations. We'll be back on Changing the World with CSU Researchers in the new year to showcase more of the important work being done by doctoral students at CSU and to explain how they're changing the world. So until then, bye-bye.